Hello, welcome to ONTIC's Connected Intelligence Podcast. I'm Fred Burton, ONTIC's Executive Director of Protective Intelligence. This podcast offers valuable insights and practical advice to help you navigate the complexities of modern corporate security shared by leaders and innovators in the field. Now, on to the discussion. Hi, I'm Fred Burton here today with Scott Stewart, my old friend Scott. Scott is the Vice President of Protective Intelligence at Torchstone Global. Scott, welcome to the ONTIC Connected Intelligence Podcast.
Well, it wasn't much of a welcome with you calling me old, Fred.
Some things are what they are, my friend. Look, we go back many, many years together, and I think it's a good time to chat about our book, The Protective Intelligence Advantage. It's very timely with the Luigi Mangione trial underway in New York City this week. As you look at that, Scott, and I know we reflected upon that in the first chapter of our book, how do you think that's changed executive protection?
Well, I think one of the things that it really highlighted was how easy it is to kill somebody. Not only for, you know, would-be attackers, but I think that board members, spouses, and CEOs and executives themselves started paying attention to the threat that can be posed by people with very little training and really not a lot of resources. And it was just, I think, a shocking wake-up call to the business community that it's time to start taking threat actors and grievance collectors seriously and to really start focusing on things like corporate security and protective intelligence.
Scott, I know we talk a lot about attacks on business people in our book, The Protective Intelligence Advantage, but as you look out over this past year in the wake of the Brian Thompson targeted killing, do you think the industry has really changed?
I think it is definitely changing. And it wasn't only the Thompson case, right? We also had, you know, that Trump assassination attempt. We had the Charlie Kirk murder. We had that, you know, the killing spree in Minnesota targeting the lawmakers. And I think more and more people are understanding that there is a need for protective intelligence, for security, and also that, you know, these attacks don't just pop up out of nowhere. You know, they can be detected. They can be proactively stopped if you have the proper preparations in place, the proper programs in place. So I think we're seeing, a wider adoption, not only of executive protection, but protective intelligence in an effort to, you know, prevent the next tragedy.
You know, after we put the book together, you know, we're now living through the aftermath of the arrest of the J6 DC bomber, which is a fascinating case. I know you and I would probably have liked to work on that one back in the day. And you look at the evolution of technology in our industry today, which for me has been one of the biggest game changers that I think I've seen in the history of the business. What are your thoughts upon that as you look back on just the evolution of technology in this space?
Well, certainly, in that J6 case, we saw not only, you know, and really going back to the Thompson murder too, the extensive CCTV coverage that we have in most of these cities that really enables the cops to track people after the fact. Unfortunately, you know, usually it's an investigative tool more than a preventative tool. But you know, the same thing goes with the way that they used the cell phone data in this J6 case to, you know, compare that in big data terms against the people who had bought certain components that were used in the device. So I think that there are a lot of new tools that are out there, and those are great for investigating things after the fact. But I think that when it comes to, really looking at things proactively and trying to prevent attacks, I think we need to really continue to focus on just simple time-tested things, right? Whether that's looking for pre-operational surveillance, whether that's doing proper advances, whether that's having security at all, where it's needed on an event. So I think that there's a lot of simple things that we shouldn't overlook just because of the security. Sure, the technology is great and it's very helpful, but it's not the be all end all. It's really supplemental, and it's also only as good as the people that use it. I mean, here we are on the Ontic podcast, and Ontic is a great tool along with a lot of the other tools that are out there. But if you don't have good analysts operating the tool, it's not going to be as effective as it can be. So you really need that human factor. You need that skill in addition to just the technology itself.
And you said something that I continue to go back on, Scott. Maybe it's my age or just the time of length in this business. But there is that brilliance and simplicity when you start thinking about, have we overcomplicated at times the executive protection process today?
Yeah, I think that perhaps some people have, or they just aren't paying attention to the basics. And as we talked about repeatedly in the book, there are usually indicators, such as pre-operational surveillance and other activities tied to the attack cycle that can be seen and can help detect these attacks, but only if people are looking for them, right? So you actually have to make the effort to detect that surveillance, to see when somebody is deploying for an attack or acquiring weapons. So we definitely need to continue to focus on those basic things, even as we adopt these new technologies.
Yeah, we learned a long time ago that you can't find surveillance unless you're looking for it. And, I wonder at times, do people really know what to look for, as we talk about in the book as well? I think that could be a lost art. What do you think?
Yes and no. But a lot of it is just situational awareness. Just going back to the Thompson case, we had some pretty good CCTV coverage of Mangione as he was lurking outside the Hilton by the building across the street there. And he was lurking. You look at the demeanor, he had no cover for action. There was no cover for status. He was just there, looked out of place, with the hood and the mask and everything. And so a lot of it is just specifically, looking for things that don't belong, people that don't belong. And that's one of the things that we're always working with our EP teams, when we're doing our EP training, trying to really focus on the demeanor. And, from our training back at the government time, when we use that acronym TED, to look for surveillance with, time, environment, distance, and demeanor. But demeanor is the biggest one. And really the thing that sticks out, especially when you have somebody that's not trained, right? And most of these attackers that we're seeing now really don't have a high degree of tradecraft when it comes to conducting attacks. And so they don't really have the ability to conduct surveillance without being detected, but only if somebody's looking for it.
And you can go back through the history of time and targeted assassinations, which we do address to some degree in our book, and think about that lone threat actor that must deploy out to that scene or venue in order to get eyes on that target. And, the unknown variable, and it's something that I still struggle with, Scott, and I think that the government, the industry, still has not done a good job with just collating data on target sets that were surveilled but not hit. For example, you and I both know, well, we know for a fact that Mangione looked at other targets or another target. We also know that, based on our experience, that this J6 bomber that was picked up, in all probability, started with a bigger list of potential targets. And for me, I think, or for our industry or for protectors, I think we really need to know what those other target sets were. And every kind of attack that we've studied and looked at, there's always been multiple targets that are looked at. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I'm totally in agreement there. That's important data, and it's it's generally overlooked, right? Because they're just, especially since most of these things become a law enforcement issue, not necessarily a protective intelligence issue. So they're looking just at that one suspect and that one target. And another good case was the Minnesota spree killings,
right?
And shootings out there, where we had that whole notebook of people that were being looked at. Even we know that the Trump shooter in Butler, the would-be assassin, had looked at other potential targets. You're definitely right that it's important. The other thing that I think we miss sometimes, Fred, is a focus on the how a little bit more, as far as how did they conduct the surveillance? There's really not that much focus on that in a typical criminal investigation, which most of these end up being, just a criminal investigation, not necessarily a protective intelligence investigation. And so there's a lot of that kind of data, the how of those attack cycles that just kind of gets missed, that could be very important for people who are trying to prevent attacks and not just convict someone who's conducted one or attempted to conduct one.
We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment. But first, I wanted to tell you about ONTIC Resources. In the world of safety, security, and protection, we know that gathering and sharing information is crucial. That is why we created our Resource Center as a hub for security strategies, best practices, and tools and tips to do your job more efficiently. Take a look at our articles, checklists, guides, industry frameworks, and more. Check out the link in the episode description to visit ONTIC Resources or visit ontic.co/resources. It's a great point, Scott, and you made me think of something else. I also think, to your point, that in the course of the interviews or interrogation of these threat actors, I just don't think those questions are being asked, primarily with the laser focus of the prosecution of just that case, which I understand completely. Having said that, from an intelligence gap perspective, it would be great to know what other target sets or venues were surveilled, were considered, that the threat actor actually deployed to the scene. As we saw in the aftermath of the first World Trade Center bombing in 93, there were so many other targets that were looked at that we were simply blind to until we started data mining some of the intelligence that surfaced as a result of that. So, but I'm still somewhat shocked that there's not a cohesive database looking at that is shared in the community. And I understand the reasons why. We know a lot of the reasons why, but there's just so much that's out there that I think that we could all benefit from if we knew. For example, if the J6 bomber conducted surveillance of 12 different targets, boy, that would be nice to know what they were, right?
Yeah, and we do get that occasionally. I mean, we've seen some sting cases, for example, where you've had kind of a would-be attacker talking to an FBI agent or informant, where they kind of talk through that kind of targeting process with target selection, target identification. A good one that I think of not too long ago was the guy who was looking to attack a church in the Pittsburgh area. And he had looked at several other targets, but decided that they were too difficult because of the security there. And so he had settled on the one church that he was going to target because it had very little security. There's no CCTV. They didn't have good access control, that sort of thing. So we do see that stuff occasionally, but unfortunately not enough. And we would really, it would be useful. And even if it's anonymized a little bit, okay, we don't have to know that it was John Smith, the president of Acme Co., that was looked at. But even if we had some generalities, this person also looked at a tech executive and decided against targeting the tech executive because it was too difficult. And we had a little bit of that in one of the cases that we talked about in the book, which was the kidnapping of Eddie Lampert.
Right.
And we know that the perpetrator, the primary perpetrator in that case, had actually done internet searches on a lot of prominent citizens, there in Connecticut. And then after kind of winnowing it down, he chose Lampert because of basically the ease. He was an easy target compared to some of the other hard targets. And actually, they diverted away from kidnapping the child to Lampert himself just because of his regular schedule. And you know, basically the results of their surveillance on him and on the office. So we do get that sometimes, but it would be extremely useful if we had more of that in more cases. And maybe that's something we can impress on listeners now that, hey, if you're working one of these investigations and you have an opportunity to see this evidence or to talk to the perpetrators, this would be great stuff to share if we can even, you know, kind of anonymized a little bit, just so that everybody can learn and benefit.
Yeah, for sure. I just don't think those questions are being asked at times, which shows the approach is not one of a protective intelligence mindset. It's just solely of let's build this case for a conviction.
That goes back to what we did at the State Department, though, right? You know, we would go out on one of these investigations with the FBI or another agency, and they were all focused just on the who. Whereas our focus, I mean, it was important for us to get out there and help find the person, bring them to justice. We didn't want to ignore that, but we also wanted to prevent the next attack. And so that's why we were so focused on that how. You know, how did they conduct this? How did they do the surveillance? How did they place the bomb? You know, whatever it was. And so looking at those mechanics so that we could detect and then deter the next attack. And that's really what we need to see more of, you know, in the industry. But then I also think, you know, in working with our government and law enforcement partners.
You know, Scott, you touched on something that I think is so critical today. And I know we talk about this in the book, too, is that digital exhaust. You know, to me, you can look at these case studies, which we've looked at, and, you know, think about those fingerprint warriors or those threat actors. I guarantee you the J6 bomber, and much like Mangione did, they get on their laptop or computer, and then they start doing their digital stalking of those potential targets. And there's so much information out there. How important is the elimination of that digital exhaust today in from your perspective in the whole concept of the protective intelligence umbrella?
Oh, no, it's huge. And of course, that's why we dedicated a whole chapter of that, you know, in our book to not doxing yourself, right? And that's one of the things that we do see happening a lot is that people really don't understand the threat that's out there. I think there's more awareness coming in, but still, by and large, they don't understand the threat that comes from those crumbs and how a threat actor can connect the dots to really get a good picture of the life patterns of a potential target. You know, we do a lot of what we call public profile assessments on our clients, and we find that it's very, very productive and very useful because they allow you to see where those gaps are, where they can be shut down. You know, there's so many cases that we've run where we have found that an executive has their Venmo account open to the public. And that allows somebody to see where they get their haircut, where their kids go to school, where they buy their coffee. You know, it's really put down that whole pattern of life. And you know, that's just dangerous. We see the same thing with Strava, the exercise app. You know, we recently did a public profile assessment on a client who had gone to great lengths to hide their residential address by, you know, basically, you know, buying it under a really, you know, covert LLC with no link to the family. So it wasn't, you know, Smith Family LLC. It was a pretty well hidden LLC name. But they also were using the office address for a lot of the formal forms. So things like political contributions, taxes, et cetera, was all going through either an attorney's office address or their corporate office. But what they did is they had Strava on an open public. And so you could see where they began and ended their workout every morning. And there again, that doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, okay, this is probably their residence. In addition to giving out the entire route, right? So if you want to assassinate this person, then you look at the route, you go out and follow it, and you look for that ideal attack site. So it just is very dangerous. And so trying to put those, you know, those pieces back undercover and to hide them is important. And of course, that's why, you know, we, you know, both you and I, but Ontic and Torchstone partner with company like 360 Privacy that is very good at that. You know, going out and trying to get the information taken down from those data aggregators so that somebody can't pay $5 you know, to run a profile through one of these data aggregation sites and get everything that they need on a target. And that's specifically what, you know, the planner of the Lampert kidnapping did, as he ran, you know, those data aggregator site reports. And then we also saw that in connection with the Minnesota case, where several of the data aggregators were listed in the notebook they found in the vehicle of the shooter. So, you know, taking that stuff down is huge and important. And hopefully the message is getting out on that.
How surprised was the client when you showed him or her that data that was so out there?
Well, no, they are surprised. And of course, then it's the easy fix, right? Hey, let's make this private. Let's shut this down. And, you know, that's the next step. The other thing that's good with when we do the public profile assessments, it also helps us see what's not out there. Okay, so this is not out there. This is not available. Keep it protected. You know, it's a dot that we don't want them to be able to find. The other thing that I think is useful with those products is that it helps desensitize clients to information shock. You know, in the past, I've worked with some individuals who are doxxed online, and they're freaking out because they're like, oh, you know, this person must be following me. They know everything about me. They know my residence soldier. They know where my children go to school, blah, blah, blah. Well, yeah, it's because your wife's posting it all on Facebook. That's why it's there. And so helping them understand where those gaps are, how you can close, you know, those vulnerabilities down is useful. But then also just helping them understand where the information comes from. So if they are doxxed, and then hopefully they understand the progression there that, okay, I've been doxxed. Maybe I need to step up security and take care of some things.
As you look back over the book we put together, The Protective Intelligence Advantage, Scott, what do you think are a couple key takeaways that folks that read the book? I know we've gotten some. It's been very humbling and great to see. We've gotten some pretty good reviews on LinkedIn and social media and so forth on the book. What are a couple of key takeaways that you would like to stress?
Well, a lot of those takeaways so far have been from security professionals, which is great. Like you said, it's humbling to know that people with a lot of experience are finding it useful. But really, I also would like to point out that you don't have to be Fred Burton to be able to do a lot of this stuff. You know, you can practice good situational awareness. You can see, you know, people conducting bad surveillance if you're looking for it. And so, you know, we provide a lot of tools in the book that obviously are useful to executive protection teams and protective intelligence teams. But there's a lot of stuff in there that is used, that can be useful just for everyday people in keeping themselves and their families safe. And it doesn't have to just be, you know, a crazed gunman that has a grievance, you know, against your company, but it can be an ordinary criminal that is targeting your family. So there's a lot of information in there that I think can be used for pretty much everyone to keep themselves and their families and their community safe.
Very well said. Now, we always end our interview, Scott, with this question. So what does connected intelligence mean to you?
Well, connected intelligence is everything because, and how I see it is the whole progression, right? It goes from the collection to the processing, the analysis, the reporting to the end user. And that whole chain is so significant and so important. And I think that sometimes people miss the idea that intelligence is for that end user. You know, it's we always had these things everywhere when I was at Fort Huachuca back in the mid 80s, right? Intelligence is for the commander. But I think that unless you keep the actual consumer of that intelligence in mind, sometimes you can miss, you know, kind of miss the boat there. So when we're thinking about connected intelligence, not just our systems within, but the people that intelligence is connecting is important as well.
Very well said. Well, Scott, as always, thank you for what you do there at Torchstone. I know you're a wonderful partner to ONTIC, and It was great collaborating on the Protective Intelligence Advantage with you. And thank you so much for being on our podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me, Fred.
Thanks for listening in. To find more episodes, visit us at ontic.co/podcasts. Don't forget to rate and subscribe on your streaming platform of choice. Know someone who would be a great podcast guest? Or have questions you'd like us to answer? Email us at podcast@ontic.co. This episode was produced by AJ McKeon. And I'm Fred Burton. Thanks for listening.